Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name's Will Aitchison. I'm going to be your host for the next 45 minutes or so while we cover recent developments in public safety labor relations. Well, we're going to get to that in just a minute. First, a couple of administrative things. If you enjoy these podcast offerings, could you please consider leaving us a positive review on iTunes? For some reason, that matters. I don't quite understand all the complexities of it, but apparently iTunes doesn't key into the number of times people listen. It really keys into the number of reviews. And iTunes reviews are critical to podcasting success. So even if you listen through another service, go give your opinion to the folks at Apple about how we do in these podcasts. Second piece of administrative detail that I wanted to cover. You know, we have a question and answers portion to our webpage, and increasingly I'm starting to use one, sometimes even more than one, of those Q&As in the course of these podcasts, because it's often the case that someone who's writing in a question is really voicing a concern that exists a lot of places around the country. Well, we've now got a phone number that you can call where you can leave your cue, your question for us. You can, and we will record it, and we'll play it on the air. Please don't leave any identifying information, of course, but we'll play it on the air, and I will try my best to give you a response. Here's the phone number that you should call. It's area code 503-836-5255. We haven't tried this yet. I think it's going to be fun to do this, to hear the actual voices of our listeners on the air. Now let's turn to what's been going on over the course of the last month. And I've got to start with the Supreme Court. Supreme Court decided a police officer free speech lawsuit. And not only that, the employee won. This is pretty amazing. I've mentioned in the past that I try to keep track of these things, and employers have an amazing one-loss record before the Supreme Court. In the last 12 to 13 years since we've had the court the way it's been kind of presently constituted, employers have, by my count, won over 90% of their cases before the Supreme Court. So when we see an employee winning a case, public employee winning a case, I mean, that's a big deal. Only this is a very, very small case. So what goes on here? This is a case involving a police officer in Paterson, New Jersey. His name is Jeffrey Heffernan. He worked in the office of the chief of police, a fellow by the name of James Wittig. At that time, the mayor of Paterson, Jose Torres, was running for re-election against a candidate by the name of Lawrence Spagnola. Had enough names for you. Torres had appointed Chief Wittig and a subordinate who directly supervised Heffernan. So, you know, arguably Chief Wittig and this subordinate had some political loyalty to Torres, to Mayor Torres. Heffernan, on the other hand, is a good friend of the challenger, of Spagnola. During the campaign, Heffernan's mom, enter mom, who is bedridden, asked Heffernan if he would drive downtown and pick up a yard sign for Spagnola, apparently a pretty big yard sign. She wanted to replace a smaller sign that she had that had been stolen from her front yard. Heffernan went to one of the places the campaign was distributing these things and picked up the sign. And while he was there, he spoke for a little while to Spagnola's campaign manager and staff, just kind of shooting the breeze, wondering what was going on. Other police officers saw him there with the sign in his hand, talking to campaign workers. And very quickly, word spread throughout the police force that Heffernan was supporting Spagnola in campaigning on duty and all of these sorts of things. And by very quickly, I mean very quickly, because the next day, the city demotes Heffernan demotes him from detective to patrol officer. Also says you're not going to be in a car, you're going to be in a walking, they call it a walking post there, a walking beat. And it was their intent, very clearly they admitted it, to punish Heffernan for what they thought was his overt involvement in Spagnola's campaign. In fact, Heffernan wasn't involved in the campaign. He was just picking up the long sign to help Mom. And Heffernan's supervisors had made a factual mistake as to whether Heffernan was involved in the campaign. So in other words, he was demoted for reasons that were mistaken. Heffernan then files a free speech lawsuit. And he contends that Chief Wittig and the other city officials, Mayor Torres, had demoted him because he had engaged in conduct that, based on their mistaken view of the facts, was protected speech. So in other words, he's saying, look, you thought you demoted me for engaging in political speech. That political speech would have been protected. Therefore, you violated the First Amendment by demoting me, even though you were wrong about the critical underlying facts. And his lawsuit is dismissed, and eventually the case makes its way to the Supreme Court. And we have a 6-2 decision that reinstates the lawsuit. And the court didn't say Heffernan won, it just simply said he has a cause of action here under the First Amendment. What's the cause of action? What's the idea behind the court's belief here that Heffernan can bring a lawsuit? The court starts with the proposition that's been around for a long, long time, that the Constitution prohibits a governmental employer from disciplining an employee because the employee supports a particular political candidate. And the whole idea is that government, as an employer, has to be neutral with respect to those issues. There's some exceptions. You can have some political patronage exceptions for very high-ranking governmental officials. And in some public employers, usually sheriff's offices, usually in the South, you will find even deputy sheriffs covered by this political patronage exception. But that doesn't go so far as to cover everyday police officers or sergeants or firefighters or corrections officers or anything like that. The court's general rules about politics apply to most public safety employees to prohibit employers from disciplining the employees for supporting a particular candidate. So then the court then has to deal with the issue that Heffernan wasn't really disciplined because he supported a candidate. He was disciplined because the employer mistakenly thought he supported a candidate. And the court asked the question, and it asked it in a very rhetorical manner, hey, since Heffernan has not engaged in these protected activities, does his constitutional case fail? And the court says, no, it doesn't. And now I'm going to read a couple of sentences from the court's opinion. The court says the government's reason for demoting Heffernan is what counts here. When an employer demotes an employee out of a desire to prevent the employee from engaging in political activity that the First Amendment protects, the employee is entitled to challenge that unlawful action under the First Amendment, even if the employer makes a factual mistake about the employee's behavior. Why? What's behind it? What's behind it, of course, is even if the employer makes a mistake, but acts for the purpose of punishing employees for supporting candidates, word is going to spread. Other employees are going to know that unless you're on the right side in a political campaign, you're going to be the target of discipline up to including discharge. And the court goes on at some length that really what we're talking about here is the greater good. I'm going to go back to the court's opinion now and quote. The court says, the discharge of one employee tells the others that they engage in protected activity at their peril. For that reason, we don't require plaintiffs in political affiliation cases to prove that they or other employees have been coerced into changing their political allegiance. The employer's factual mistake doesn't diminish the risk of causing precisely that same harm. Now, you had two dissenting opinions. It was a 6-2 vote. It's probably not a surprise to anybody who listens to these podcasts or watch the Supreme Court that the dissenting opinion was written by Justice Clarence Thomas. Justice Thomas finds it pretty hard to vote for an employee in these sorts of cases. And Justice Thomas ends up saying that in order for Heffernan to win, he'd have to prove that he was engaged in political activity. But that dissenting view didn't carry the day. We have a 6-2 vote for an employee in a free speech case before the Supreme Court. You can't convince me that the departure of Antonin Scalia through his untimely death from the court, you can't convince me that that's not having an impact. Justice Scalia would have firmly been on the side of the city in this sort of case. And he had an influence on the court, particularly the justices in the middle who waffle from time to time as to which side they're on. He had an influence that was profound. And I think this is the first case where we're really seeing how his absence shaped the outcome of these employment cases before the court. Incidentally, we were doing a seminar last week in Las Vegas on collective bargaining, and I put up on the overhead projector, I put up the pictures of the eight current Supreme Court justices. And it appears we're going to be stuck at eight, right? It doesn't appear that we're going to have any confirmation hearings on Merrick Garland. It looks like that's going to be blocked in the Senate. And it was striking to me when you put the faces of these eight guys and gals up on a slide, striking to me to realize that three of those eight are going to be in their 80s during the first term of whoever the next president is. And so it may well be that the next president is going to appoint four out of the court's nine justices, the one empty seat, and then the three justices who may or may not serve out the term of the next president. That may be one of the most important things that this next presidential election is about, is who the justices will be who will be selected by the next president. I'll tell you, it certainly will be important in these labor and employment cases. Next up, we've got a big deal, another big deal, this one coming out of California. And understand this, it's a case about a process known as fact-finding. To understand this, you have to understand a little bit about California's collective bargaining laws. And California doesn't have a collective bargaining law, it has laws. The main collective bargaining law in California that covers most public employees is known as the Meyer-Milius-Brown Act, or as they call it in California, MMBA. The act was written a long time ago. It calls for a meet and confer process. And at the end of the meet and confer process, the employer is free to unilaterally implement its last best offer. So no binding arbitration under the collective bargaining law, at least as it was originally drafted. Now, some cities and counties in California have, from time to time, adopted a binding arbitration model, which they can if they do so on a local option charter basis. But that's a minority of cities and counties. I've kind of lost track, but it's somewhere around 30 cities and counties have binding arbitration. So the vast, vast majority, well over 500 cities and counties in California, are covered by the meet and confer provisions of the Meyer-Milius-Brown Act. Well, a number of years ago, police and firefighters convinced the California state legislature to move to a binding arbitration model for the entire state. That didn't last very long because the California Supreme Court ruled that under a fairly unusual home rule provision of the California Constitution, that binding arbitration as a matter of state law was not permitted. Now, binding arbitration could still continue on this local option basis, but it wasn't permitted as a matter of state law. The police and firefighters kind of licked their wounds for a little while, and then a whole bunch of labor organizations got back together, made a pitch to the California legislature, and the legislature adopted a fact-finding approach. So what's that? After the meet and confer process is done, there is a new stage in the bargaining process known as fact-finding. And in fact-finding, a neutral third party selected by both sides, usually from a list, a neutral third party, hears evidence. And it's the sort of evidence you'd hear in binding arbitration. It's evidence on the cost of living, the employer's budget, wages and benefits in comparable jurisdictions, recruitment and retention, all of those sorts of things get considered in the fact-finding process. And at the end, the fact-finder makes a non-binding recommendation to both sides. If the fact-finder's recommendation is not adopted by both sides, then the employer is free to unilaterally implement its last best offer. So what fact-finding is a way of bringing a neutral third party into the equation without the ability to make a final and binding decision. It's just a recommendation. Well, several employers challenged the fact-finding statute, and eventually those challenges took two separate forms. Two cases wound up in the California Court of Appeals. One of them was that fact-finding, just like binding arbitration, violates that home rule provision of the California Constitution. And secondly, even if fact-finding were constitutional, it only applied to the meet and confer process on a new contract and could not apply to what's known as single issue negotiations that might occur during the term of the contract. And I'm going to talk about that latter one in some length. But first of all, let's talk about, is fact-finding like binding arbitration? Court had an easy time with that and said, no, it's not. And the reason it's not is the fact-finder doesn't make a decision. And so it doesn't implicate the home rule provisions of the California Constitution in the same way that binding arbitration would be. The employer still has the right to unilaterally implement its last best offer. Now let's turn to the bigger issue, the single issue question. Well, how do you get single issue fact-finding? How would that occur? Well, remember that the obligation to collectively bargain also applies when an employer wants to make a change in past practice in something that's mandatory for bargaining. So whenever the employer wants to make a change in wages or hours or mandatorily negotiable working conditions, it has to, if the union asks, it has to go through the meet and confer process. Now, thanks to the court's opinion, that meet and confer process, if it doesn't produce an agreement, is followed by fact-finding. And that means it's followed by a process of selecting a fact-finder, a process of scheduling the hearing, of putting on the hearing, of post-hearing briefs, a process then of the fact-finders writing their recommendations, and then the process of the parties evaluating the recommendations and accepting or rejecting them. In other words, the California midterm bargaining process just got a whole lot slower than it was before. What the power is of fact-finding, power for unions is for fact-finding, is that it enables unions to gain additional time before the employer can unilaterally implement. To be sure, I don't want to kind of put aside another benefit of fact-finding. You bring a skilled third party in, and it may be you end up finding a solution you wouldn't otherwise find. But from a practical standpoint, is that the big deal? The big deal is that instead of being able to unilaterally implement a change in a matter of weeks or maybe a month or two, California employers are now facing the prospect that if the union asks for fact-finding, it may take as long as a year or even longer to implement changes during the term of a contract. As you might imagine, employers have promised appeals to the California Supreme Court, and stay tuned for future developments. While I'm talking about these unilateral change issues, changes in wages, hours, or working conditions, we got an interesting case that came out of New Jersey in the last month involving step increases. What do you do with step increases after a contract has expired? Step increases, for the purposes of this example, let's assume there's step increases that are automatically granted on an employee's anniversary date, absent any sort of evidence of misconduct or some serious lack of performance on the employee's part. Well, this brings up what's known as the status quo rule. And the status quo rule requires an employer, after a contract expires, while the parties are negotiating for a new contract, requires an employer to maintain the status quo, the existing levels of wages, hours, and working conditions. There's two ways you can look at this. One way is known as the static status quo rule. And the static status quo rule says that the status quo is established by the actual wages themselves that employees are getting. So if you have an employee at step five is making $4,000 a month, the contract expires, their anniversary date happens 3 days later, well, the status quo is $4,000 a month, so you've got to maintain that $4,000 a month, and you can't give the employee their normal step increase. That's the static status quo rule. That's only followed by a minority of states. Most states follow what's known as the dynamic status quo rule. And with this approach, the status quo is seen not as the actual wages that employees receive, but rather the fact that routine step increases are granted on an employee's anniversary date. And with a dynamic status quo rule, it would be an unfair labor practice or prohibited practice or whatever it's called in your state for an employer to not grant employees wage increases on their anniversary dates. As I said, this is an issue on which there's not unanimity, but I think it's safe to say the vast majority of states follow the dynamic status quo rule, and that requires to give employers to give step increases after a contract has expired, even though a new contract has not yet been negotiated or produced by arbitration. So what's happened in the last month is we had a New Jersey court step in and really reprimand, scold. It's a really fascinating opinion. New Jersey's Public Employment Relations Commission for changing the way it viewed the status quo rule with respect to step increases. So these are two consolidated cases. One involves the township of Bridgewater and another Atlantic County, which is where Atlantic City is. In each case, the employer stopped paying step increases after the contract expired. In each case, the unions filed grievances challenging the failure to give step increases. And in each case, the employer refused to arbitrate. And in each case, New Jersey's Public Employment Relations Commission ruled in favor of the employers, and the unions appealed. And what was the reason that PERC ruled in favor of employers? It adopted the static status quo rule and said, look, we're going to view the status quo as based on the actual wages that the employees received. And that's what earned it the scolding from the appeals court in New Jersey. The court said to PERC, I mean, it said to all of us, but really, this is almost a personal opinion. I really recommend you take a look at this. It's pretty good recreational reading. The court said to PERC, look, You adopted the status quo rule in 1975, 41 years ago. And you adopted the dynamic status quo rule. And you even gave a very good example of it. You said it's the generally accepted view in the public and private sectors that the employer can't alter the status quo while engaged in bargaining. And one of the areas that the status quo applies is post-expiration step increases. So the court says to PERC, you decided this issue 41 years ago, and you have decided it several times since then. And you changed your mind in this case. And why'd you change? And the court doesn't actually say this out loud, so it's left to, you know, snarky people like me to say it. Well, the reason PERC changed is, of course, politics have changed. You have PERC commissioners, I believe, if I'm reading the webpage correctly, the majority of whom have now been appointed by Governor Chris Christie, and the whole politics of collective bargaining in the public sector, and in particular public safety employees, these are both police cases, has changed. And it has changed in a way that favors employers more. And what the court ends up saying is you have not come up with an acceptable rationale for abandoning the dynamic status quo rule. Here's what the court had to say. The court says, PERC, what you've decided is that a post-expiration requirement that employers give pay increases creates myriad instability in the negotiations process. You then, say the court, refer to changing economic conditions, and you take the position that governmental budgetary constraints trump labor considerations. And you closed, PERC, with the notion that the dynamic status quo no longer fulfills the needs of the parties in that it serves as a disincentive to the prompt settlements of labor disputes and actually disserves amicable collective bargaining. The appeals court says, you can't do that, PERC. You've acted as a legislative body by changing the way you formulated the status quo rule without any rationale other than a financial rationale. Here are the court's words, and you'll see what I mean when I say this is a scolding of an opinion. PERC's decision, undertaken in an area in which the legislature did not act, was driven by the tax levy cap, concerns regarding governmental budgets, and not the collective bargaining law. A tax cap is beyond PERC's mandate. Concerns regarding budgets are not a primary consideration when the agency is charged with safeguarding the rights of public employees. PERC's interpretation of the law is outside of its charge and is entitled to no special deference. Whoa! Ouch! Courts don't normally talk in those sorts of terms. And you know what? The Court of Appeals actually wasn't through. The court goes on to say, look, PERC found that the cost-saving impetus behind the tax cap and the dynamic status quo rule conflicted. And on balance, it gave greater weight to the tax cap. By doing so, said the court, PERC undermined its legislative mandate. It did not act as a labor board. In other words, it acted as some sort of financial board. The court is also very clearly here concerned about this, the need for stability in the way a labor board formulates such a basic rule as this. And the status quo rule is really a basic principle of labor relations. Here's how the court closes out its opinion, and I think this is really an important part of the court's rationale. The court says the parties relied on this dynamic status quo doctrine in bargaining their contracts. By altering its course, PERC undermine the party's legitimate expectations based on their negotiations. Finally, Perk wrongly assumed that government employers cannot negotiate to avoid paying salary increments after the lapse of contracts. In other words, employers, you got a choice here. You got an option. If you don't want to pay step increases after a contract is expired, write it into the contract. That's easy. And if you fail to write it into the contract and you have to pay those step increases, well, it's perfectly permissible for you to try to negotiate to recoup what you've paid. But it's a bottom line proposition, the court is saying to New Jersey's PERC, and this is just a stinging slap, is saying you are not a legislature. You cannot fundamentally change labor relations rules and laws and expectations just because of financial considerations. Those principles have to be the most important thing in your decision-making process. Let's head over to Iowa for a brief moment for a duty of fair representation issue. This is one that comes to us courtesy of our Q&A page on our website. And here's the way the question came in, and this is from the union side of the table. Although, let me go off on one of these tangents again, although employers need to be concerned about the duty of fair representation as well. Because if a union breaches its duty of fair representation, it's possible for the employer to have to pay the remedy. So there's actually an interest for employers to make sure that unions do a good job in understanding their obligations under the duty of fair representation. So here's the question that came in. Our union represents our members for collective bargaining, retirement, discipline, etc., virtually all matters. The next question is whether we should be representing our members in workers' comp issues for job-related injuries. We have often told our members that they should seek attorneys on their own and seek advice from a workers' comp attorney. However, are we liable for breach of duty of fair representation if we don't offer to help the employees during a work-related injury? All right, to answer this question, you got to understand something that's a little bit unusual about the duty of fair representation, and it's not really the way you think it's going to come out. The duty of fair representation is pretty much the only legal obligation that a union has to its members. And the duty is essentially a procedural one in nature. It obligates a union to use a fair process in considering grievances and other claims by members. It doesn't compel a particular result. The duty of fair representation doesn't require a union to take a grievance, for example, to arbitration. It doesn't require a union to go file a lawsuit. A union is entitled to take into consideration not just the merits of the case, but the cost of litigating the case and the possibility that adverse precedent may be created that would impact the bargaining unit as a whole, can take into account a myriad of considerations. What's most important for the duty of fair representation is that it requires fair procedures. The member has to be able to fairly state their argument to the union, make their pitch to the union as to why the union should be taking one position or another. The duty of fair representation only applies to subject matters where the union has taken on the job of being the exclusive representative of employees. And by exclusive, I mean the union is the only one that can represent the employees in that forum, wherever that forum might be. So, for example, most collective bargaining agreements say only the union has the right to refer a grievance to arbitration, while the union is the exclusive representative for purposes of grievances and grievance arbitration. That means the duty of fair representation exists. Also, the union is the only one who can negotiate a collective bargaining agreement. Hence, there's a duty of fair representation imposed on the union in the collective bargaining process. But there are lots of areas that firefighter and police and corrections unions where they get asked by their members to provide a representative where the union wouldn't be the exclusive representative. For example, I have seen unions that I have represented get asked to provide a lawyer for criminal charges. Well, is the union the exclusive representative in the area of defending an employee against criminal charges? Of course not. The employee can get their own lawyer. Therefore, no duty of fair representation. No duty to even consider granting the request. No duty to follow fair procedures. The duty of fair representation never existed in the first place because the union wasn't the exclusive representative. The same thing is true with respect to this question. Is the union the exclusive representative for purposes of pursuing workers' comp claims? No, it's not. Workers' comp statutes allow employees to be represented by counsel or other third parties. The union hasn't bargained to be the exclusive representative in workers' comp cases, hence, no duty of fair representation to begin with. And you see this come up in just a wide variety of different circumstances. For example, I know of unions that have been asked to provide divorce attorneys. No duty of fair representation there, to be sure. I've seen unions be asked to provide attorneys for disability claims, for an off-duty disability. No duty of fair representation there. And this principle goes far. It's an oldie but goodie case that comes out of Minneapolis involving the Minneapolis Police Federation, and it involved due process hearings, pre-disciplinary due process hearings, Loudermill hearings as they're known. And a police officer who filed a duty of fair representation claim against the union for not providing him with representation in the Loudermill hearing, in the due process hearing. And Minnesota's Court of Appeals looked at it and said, well, under the employer's rules, can the employee be represented by somebody other than the union? Yeah, the employee can be represented by an attorney. Said the court, no duty of fair representation, so long as the union hasn't bargained to be the exclusive representative. So whenever you hear about a union being asked to provide an attorney or provide some other sort of representative in this form or that, the first question you should always be asking is, has the union taken on the responsibility of being the exclusive representative for employees? If the answer is no, you don't go any further. There is no duty of fair representation in that environment. This month's Binding Arbitration Means Binding Arbitration case comes to us courtesy of Ohio, and it is a police case. And maybe I should slightly alter that headline just a bit. Binding arbitration means binding arbitration, even if it involves sexting. This is a case that comes out of the Cleveland Police Department. A detective by the name of Vincent Lucarelli. I apologize to the detective if I'm mispronouncing his name. And this all starts in May 2012. When Internal Affairs in Cleveland opens up an investigation into Lucarelli's conduct. It has found cell phone records, which had been subpoenaed for a criminal case involving a private investigator. The cell phone records indicated that Lucarelli had been sexting women, including the victims of several criminal cases on which he had been working or was currently working or had worked. The department goes out and does an internal affairs investigation. It ends up with seven women that Lucarelli had either texted or sexted while on duty and with whom he had a romantic relationship or tried to have a romantic relationship. Two of the women were victims in criminal investigations that Lucarelli had handled 2 to 3 years earlier. And he later came into contact with them, and in one case he admitted to using an unmarked police car to transport these women within his district and to pick up groceries and other items for him. He admitted to stopping at one of their houses while he was on duty and staying there for what the court refers to as periods of time. He admitted collecting pay for time he had not worked because he was hanging out at this woman's house, and to touching the women in an affectionate manner, that's in quotes in the court's opinion again, while they were in his police car. Lucarelli admitted to other things. He admitted to flirtatious texting with a neighbor with whom he had a sexual relationship. He once left the city using his city car to pick her up in a snowstorm. Another woman that Lucarelli texted in a manner that even she referred to it as harmless flirting was a felonious assault victim. And he texted a suspect in a criminal investigation attempting to flirt with her. She didn't respond to his texts. Those weren't the most serious cases. The most serious cases involved victims in two active criminal investigations to which Lucarelli was assigned. In one case, Lucarelli texted the victim saying that her baby's father was a loser, and she needed someone like Lucarelli to protect her. And in the other case, he sent text about the status of the victim's case and described his desire to come over to her house and engage in various sex acts with her. The investigation turned up other evidence of transgressions by Lucarelli. He failed to show up for a Garrity interview, saying that he overslept. He failed to obtain necessary authorization prior to working as a security guard in a local liquor store, and other things. The city fires Lucarelli, and the union challenges his termination in arbitration. And the arbitrator ends up reinstating him. And the arbitrator reinstates him because the arbitrator says actually several things. First of all, the city failed to properly make a suggestion as to whether anything less than discharge would be appropriate. The arbitrator looks at the past practices in the city with respect to discipline for these sorts of things and ends up thinking, when all is said and done, that Lucarelli should be reinstated without back pay. The city, though, is having none of that and challenges the arbitrator's decision in court. And the city's basic argument is, look, the evidence is overwhelming that Lucarelli should be terminated. And for an arbitrator to rule any other way must mean that the arbitrator is departing from his authority under the collective bargaining agreement. The court upholds the arbitrator's decision. Remember the headline here, binding arbitration means binding arbitration. And here's what the court says to the city. You got a contract here. Part of that contract is you agreed to have disputes settled by an arbitrator rather than a judge. And because of that, we have to accept the arbitrator's determination of the facts. The way the court puts it is, courts do not sit to hear claims of factual or legal error by an arbitrator, as an appellate court does in reviewing the decisions of local courts. An arbitrator must find facts, and a court may not reject those findings simply because it disagrees with them. The same is true of the arbitrator's interpretation of the contract. And turning to Lucarelli's case, the court says, whether or not the city had just cause, that's a factual determination to be made by an arbitrator. The arbitrator here looked at the nature and frequency of Lucarelli's misconduct, looked at the opinions of his supervisors, looked at the fact that none of the women had complained of his conduct, that there was no demonstrable impact on any criminal investigation and prosecution. The arbitrator considered the very sort of things you'd want a finder of fact to consider. Now, we might have come up with a different result if this case were presented to us, but that's not the point. The point is, when you have contracted to have final and binding arbitration, you are stuck with that arbitrator's decision absent a fraud or absent a decision where The public policy is so overwhelming and demands discharge that the arbitrator's opinion cannot be upheld. And this isn't one of those public policy cases. So the court ends up ordering the enforcement of the arbitrator's award. You know, there's a lot of money that is wasted by employers and by unions around the country appealing arbitrators' decisions. Courts like arbitration. They like arbitration maybe for a venal reason, that if we all agree to arbitration of disputes, it gets those disputes out of the court system. I mean, can you think of how many places in your life you have agreed to binding arbitration? Have you bought a car lately? Read the fine print. You've probably agreed to binding arbitration. You borrowed money on your house? Have you signed up for a Visa card? Have you purchased airplane tickets? You'd be shocked if you read that fine print how many different places in your life you have agreed to final and binding arbitration. And what happens to the dockets of the courts if all of a sudden there is free and easy appeals from arbitrators' decisions? The dockets explode, right? So courts, purely from a selfish standpoint, want final and binding arbitration to mean final and binding arbitration. But in the labor context, there's even, I think, another, maybe even more important bias. The whole notion that you see behind these court decisions on labor arbitration really was articulated first by the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1960s in a series of cases involving the Steelworkers Union. They're called the Steelworkers Trilogy. The court says, look, a labor contract is really a special beast. What you are creating when you're creating an arbitration system is kind of a law of the shop with respect to the way your collective bargaining agreement is interpreted and applied. You get to create your own brand of industrial justice, you meaning employers and unions. And that system that you have created, a system that culminates with binding arbitration, that is a system that has worked. It is a system that has produced labor peace, and it is a system that we think should be allowed to breathe. And that's why we are not going to very easily, if almost ever, tamper with the results of an arbitrator's opinion. So if you're on the losing end of an arbitration decision, and you're thinking, we got to appeal, do your homework first. Take a look at what the decisions of your courts are on the appeals of arbitration decisions. And, you know, unless there's some sort of reasonable chance out there, don't be spending tens of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees chasing after something that will never be accomplished. Courts like binding arbitration. Well, that's it for this month. We look forward to seeing you at June's seminar in Las Vegas. We're going to be doing our usual seminar on the rights of law enforcement officers, talking about constitutional rights and rights under federal statutes of law enforcement officers. We're going to have some focus on things like body cameras and the like, and in particular a long focus on the continuing evolution of the Brady Rule. But even if we don't see you there, check in with us with LRAS from time to time. Consider using that Q&A phone number I gave you to get in touch with us and leave your questions that we can then address on the air. With that, this is Will Aitchison signing off. Have a great month.